A sermon by Reverend Richard A. Rem, preached at Christ Community Church in Spring Lake, Michigan, on July 24, 1994, in the Job series, entitled, Retribution is Not God's Idea. The scripture readings were selected verses from Job chapters 20 and 21, and Job 42, verses 7 through 9. The texts for the sermon are Job 20, verses 4 and 5, chapter 21, verse 7, and chapter 42, verse 7. Copyright, Grand Valley State University.
I was thinking about the serenity and the beauty of Psalm 23 as it was sung a moment ago. Incidentally, you've got one more week. Those of you can join the summer choir next week, last week. Get a robe. Stick with it for 5 years and get a cross. But I was thinking, as a melodious song, beautiful words, comforting and reassuring, were floating over you and you seemed to be at peace, I thought of a conversation I had last evening with a good friend of mine, a pastor, who has just gone through radiation, having encountered cancer. Asked him how he was. He said, doing pretty good. He said, I'm speaking to God again. He said, in the midst of it, we kind of got separated for a while. Well, you know, all the wonderful religious comfort in the world, which we really believe, by which we live, by which we are undergirded and overshadowed and enabled and empowered, all of that, so terribly important and so wonderful, sometimes comes into collision with our real life situation, and all of a sudden it can evaporate, it can raise doubts and questions, and we can wonder, where is God in this moment and in this darkness? I think that's what happened to Job. The poet who wrote this dramatic poem had obviously come into a crisis of faith. Maybe, as poets generally are, he was a spokesperson for a lot of people who had come into a crisis of faith. What they had learned in Sunday school just wasn't working anymore. They couldn't connect what they were experiencing with what they had always held to be true about God. And so he raised a serious protest against the generally received wisdom of the day about the relationship of God to our lives. And what the poet claimed was in the question of last week, that there is not a one-to-one relationship between sin and punishment, virtue and reward. What he said was, is you can't tell whether a person is virtuous or wicked by looking at their life, their happiness, their prosperity, or their lack thereof. He said, it just doesn't work that way. In my human experience and what I see about me, even though that's what I once believed and that's what you friends are trying to convince me of anew, I don't believe it. I'm not going to make a lot of progress today, because when I get into a series like this, I get thinking about it about 8 days a week, and I find often that I move too rapidly, and so I'm stalling this morning. If you were here last week, you can leave now. No. My next line, Charlie, leave your offering on the narthex table. That came from the operations council. Now, what I want to say this morning is just a little different spin on what I said last week. This morning, I simply want to say that retribution is not God's idea. Tribute is payment. Retribution is repayment. It reflects an idea of human experience and of the way the world is that says it's tit for tat. You do A, you get B. You do C, you get D. And the one who is turning the dials and pushing the keys is God, the moral cop striding in heaven, observing creatures on earth, giving just deserts, whether for weal or woe, depending on whether one is good or bad. That was a very early conception of things, and as I said last week, in saying that is not the case, we've got to make some qualifications. We've got to recognize that there's a whale of a lot of Bible that says that that's the case, at least as superficially understood. It would seem to say many places in the Scripture that it is a matter of being good and being blessed, being evil and being punished, and the implication of that that was drawn against which Job protested was that if you are punished, therefore you have been evil. No one suffers if one is innocent. There's a lot of Bible that would seem to indicate a very close relationship between being good and being blessed, being evil and being punished. Beyond that, you don't have to be a Bible student to realize that that makes sense. We all know that there are certain patterns of behavior that engaged in will result in happiness and prosperity and well-being. And there are certain patterns of behavior, if engaged in, will result in disaster and self-destruction. So, there is a certain truth in the fact that our human action and human behavior has its consequences. Don't hear me denying that. That must be obvious. Maybe I should add a third qualification, and that is that to live in human community or human society, we do need a system of justice. We live as a nation under a constitution. That constitution is interpreted and reinterpreted, and its laws are applied. And apart from that, it wouldn't be possible to live in community or to have human society. I wouldn't want to live in a society where good and evil were just indiscriminately affirmed, or where it didn't matter. It does matter. You can't live together unless there is some law, some structure, some order. And human beings being as they are, it is necessary that there be some enforcement of that order. A great theologian of the last generation, Reinhold Niebuhr, wrote a book about society, and I can remember being struck by it at that time many, many years ago, where he said the ideal for human community is not love, but justice. And I said, oh, come on, it must be love. Love is higher than justice. But his point was that in society you cannot legislate, nor can you enforce love. Love is not for legislating, and love is not for enforcing, but justice you can legislate, and justice you can enforce. And I think that was at the time, for example, of the civil rights movement of the 60s and so forth. And at that time, there were those who were saying, you can't legislate, you know, this decency and community and all of that. And Reinhold Niebuhr said, oh, yes, you can. There is a standard of justice that can be legislated, and it should be enforced, because even though we cannot affect through any human means a loving community, we can affect a just community. So that's important. But having said that, it still doesn't get at the nub of Job's protest. Job's protest was, I am suffering. I am innocent. Therefore, there is not a one-to-one relationship between human behavior and the consequence. Job was so convinced of his own experience that he was willing even to accuse heaven. He sort of bought in with his friends to the idea that God was doing these things, pulling the strings and pushing the buttons, busying God's self with all of the stuff that makes up our life. He sort of bought into that. I mean, he did buy into that. He was a part of that. But what he couldn't go along with out of his own experience was the fact that, therefore, if one is suffering, one is being punished for sin, either known or unknown. So he accused God of being unjust. Now that really got the ire of his friends up, and they went on the attack. Job had a lot to learn too. And we'll get to that eventually. Out of the whirlwind, Job had to say, I didn't know what I was talking about. Sorry. But the important point that Job made in the protest that was brought to expression in this dramatic poem was that there is suffering in human experience, there is tragedy in human experience, there are things that happen to us that are disastrous, and we ought not, first of all, to blame the victim, or if we're the victim, to blame ourselves. Job's point was that God never intended a retributive system to be put in place, enforced by God's all-seeing eye and authority. Job said, I don't know why I'm suffering. I don't understand suffering. But in the human situation, I am suffering and I am innocent. His friend said, can't be. Zophar says, look, the text is printed in the bulletin, has a misprint. It doesn't say that the wicked's joy costs but a moment, but it should say the wicked's happiness and prosperity lasts but a moment. For if Job would point to so-and-so, they'd say, ah, yes, but that's ephemeral. That's going to pass away. Just wait. The psalmist in Psalm 73 had a problem with the prosperity of the wicked, as Job did, but then he came to see, he said, and then I contemplated their end. Ah, you have set them on a slippery slope. Oh, just wait till they get theirs. Now Zophar said, the happiness or the prosperity of the wicked is an illusion, finally, God will get him. Job said, "Oh, really? Oh, really? Is his candle so quickly snuffed out? Not what I observe. I see reckless, careless people, grandchildren frolicking on the lawn and jumping on their lap. I see the wicked prosper." And in the resolution of the book, which I read also, God says to the friends, "I'm angry with you. You didn't speak truly about me as my servant Job did." Now Job's got a lot to learn yet. Job's going to go through the whirlwind. Job at this point doesn't have it all right. But Job's friends have it all wrong. And that's the point. Retribution is not God's idea. No tit for tat. No God striding around heaven, observing your behavior, to prosper you if you tithe, and bomb you if you don't come to church. Now, we preachers wish that were the case. And we have a long history of implying that that might be the case. And on second thought, you can't be too safe. But that is an abuse of religion. That is a manipulation of people. That is speaking to people's vulnerabilities. I'm always surprised at how seriously you take sermons. Someone said to me on the way out this morning, "Well, what?" I said, "I don't know. Don't believe me. Let me raise some questions we ought to think about, but don't expect me to give you a simple answer, because I might be just as miserable as Job's friends, or I might be as off the track as Job before the whirlwind." The wisdom books out of which we are preaching really say to people, don't listen to preachers, begin to think for yourself. The wisdom books are books that call God's people to maturity, to stop using God as a security blanket, as a safety shield, using prayer to pass the buck to God, when it's our responsibility to work at human community, at concerns of justice and righteousness and compassion. And to stop doing what Jesus forbiddeth to do anyway, and that is to judge other people or ourselves in our human situation. William Safire, in his book, The First Dissident, in the quote that I have in the bulletin last week, it says, "Don't blame the victim." And then he uses the example of the person with AIDS. Haven't you heard it? You haven't? Good. You don't watch preachers on television or listen to the radio. But if you do, if you have that addiction, I'll bet you sometime or other you've heard one suggest that there's a plague on America, the HIV virus, because of homosexuality and those people or non-persons coming out of the closet and making a big uproar in society. Well, Job would say, no. You can't do that. He would say, for one thing, you don't just take a class of people and write them off. And for another thing, you being people who are called to maturity and to growth and to reasonableness and decency, know of all the information and data that's available to us today, so that the matter of orientation, sexual orientation, is a matter of orientation, not necessarily a matter of choice. Now, if you want to get back in that other realm, the Bible has a lot to say about promiscuity and hetero or homosexual relationships, but it doesn't talk about orientation per se. And so then for people just to say, oh, there's a plague, God is judging, that's nonsense. It's cruel. It's not true. Sapphire says, a woman's raped. Easy to say. She got what she deserved. Her people's houses are flooded because they live on the river bottom. Say, stupid people. God's judging them for their stupidity. No. No. Job says, that's not what God's into. God is not into tit for tat. God is not walking a beat in heaven in order to keep a bead on you and all of that. God says, here's life, here's creation, live it, be responsible, be mature, stand up and be a human person. The God that Job is going to meet in the whirlwind that lies yet before us is a God who's going to blow Job away. Job isn't going to get all of his little questions answered. He's not going to get a nice, neat scheme of things. And I want to say at this point that if you have a good and satisfying relationship with God and your faith system is working for you, far be it from me to try to move you off from that. But as your pastor, I know that some of you one day will come into an experience where if you haven't thought these things through, your faith is going to crash on the rocks of reality. And then I would like to be able to say to you, there's something bigger and better. And the reason to think these things through is that if we should come into a Jobian experience, I would hope it would lead us to the whirlwind of revelation in order that our God would not crumble before the assault of tragedy and human suffering, but rather that God might become grander and greater. For what Job finally had to learn, I think the outcome of the book will be this, that God ought to be served because God is worthy to be served. That one should be in awe before God because God is awesome. That God is such that one can trust and cling even in the darkness. And that virtue carries its own reward. In other words, that one simply ought to be good for nothing. If one is good for nothing. Then one is good for the only good reason there is to be good. And if one catches a glimpse of the grandeur and the glory of God, then one will have another way and a better way to stand in any storm of life. Job didn't have it all right yet, but in the end, God said, that other stuff, it's wrong. Job has set it right.